Accession number 18266, Reel 1.
Mrs. Beasley, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born at Esher in Surrey, 1925.
Can you tell me something about your family background, and possibly, especially about your father, please?
Well, my father was in the Royal Navy. He'd been a sailor all his life. And so we led a pretty peripatetic life as a child. We lived in, went backwards and forwards to Malta several times. And in the early 30s, we went out to Japan. My father was naval attaché out there. And so we went out there as children for nearly 3 years. So we travelled around a lot and were very typical naval family, really. But just before the war, and about 1936, we moved to Cornwall, and my parents bought a house there, and we settled there in the country, outside Bodmin, on the edge of Bodmin Moor. And that was an idyllic place for children to grow up. Lovely place, peaceful and quiet. Real country family life.
I think we should say that your father was Admiral Rawlings.
Yes, that's quite right. He had a very successful career and simply loved the Navy, loved his job, thought that what he was doing was a quite exceptional chance to have a wonderful life. And I grew up with the idea and that the Navy was the finest career, and it was always called the senior service in those days, but it was a wonderful life before the war.
What was your father like from the point of view of character and personality?
Oh, he was a very strong personality, a very intelligent, and if I say cultured man, I say it because he was immensely interested in the fine things of life, like pictures and furniture and architecture, and he was a very honourable man and cared deeply about things like that. And so we grew up with the idea that there were beautiful things in the world as well as just being a naval life and a naval family, which was quite unusual in those days, to have him so knowledgeable about languages and other people and different cultures and different ideas and different religion. He was a remarkable man.
What was his attitude towards the outbreak of war?
Well, because he was in Japan as naval attaché up till 37, 38, he had strong feelings about the Japanese and what they were doing in the Far East, because when we were in Japan, what the Japanese called the incident in Manchuria had taken place. And I know that my father was very unhappy about what was going on with the Japanese out in the Far East. As far as the European scene went, I certainly remember as a child of about 10 or 11, 12, my parents being very, very unhappy about what was going on in Europe. There was alarm about the way Germany was going. Yes, he was very aware of the political situation and how disturbing it was.
When were you in Japan?
When he first went out there. What year did the king die? King George the
Fifth. Was it 1935?
I think it was. Well, he died as we were going out on the boat, as we were going out. And so that's when we went out, 35, 36, 37, 38. Yes, those were the 3 years that he was naval attaché in Tokyo.
So you were living in Japan from 35 to 38?
That's right. Well, my brother and I came back because we had to come back to school. But the first 2.5 years we were there with my parents. Very interesting days.
Can you tell me about it, please?
We lived in Tokyo. Actually, when we first arrived in Japan, two brothers and I, and a governess who we'd taken out with us, for the simple reason that there was all the schools, of course, in Japan, the education was in Japanese, and so we, My parents took an extraordinarily nice woman who was a governess out with us. And she and my brothers and I, we all went down to a place called Kamakura, where we waited while there was an uprising of some sort in Tokyo. That was in 1935. And when that was over and done with, we went back to Tokyo and we lived there as a family. And the English governess became extremely popular because a lot of people in the embassies, not just the British embassy, but the other embassies, couldn't find schools for their children. And so they used to send their sons and daughters to our house, and we all used to do lessons in English together, led by this remarkably good governess. And so it was very pleasant, and we had a little school, really, of about 9 or 10 people, all working in our house. So as children, we were very happy there. It's a lovely place to live before the war.
Why was that?
It was a lot... it was a very free life. I think my parents travelled quite a bit in Japan. In the summertime, we used to go up to a place called Chosenze, near Nikko. And we had 2 months up there. My mother came, and all the people from the embassies in Tokyo used to go up there, because Tokyo was so hot in the summer. And it was a wonderful lake, and all the families lived around the lake, and everybody mixed together. And all the different nationalities from the different embassies. It was a lovely place. And for children, of course, it was an absolute paradise. Sailing and swimming and things like that. But it was... And my father used to come up from Tokyo when he could. And we travelled about in Japan a certain amount. And they were very interesting days. Of course, in those days, of course, the hierarchy of society in Japan was absolutely fixed, with the emperor as the semi-divine, really. And the whole of Japanese society was very well arranged, and religion meant a great deal. The temples and all the ceremonies that went on in the temples were very set and organized. But it was a very pleasant place to live as a foreigner. People were never unkind or rude or unpleasant. Good place.
Did you feel any xenophobia?
No, I don't think so. Not then. No. We loved it then. I think that what happened during the war and the terrible stories that came out about Japan, and particularly about the prisoner of war camps, I think that was that initially seemed extraordinary, because we'd had a different view of Japan, having lived there. But extraordinary, really. I had a great friend who was a Japanese girl, little girl, and her father was a rich and probably influential man. And we were great friends, and she came to do lessons with us in our house. And we had written to each other after I came back to England. And at the end of the war, of course I hadn't heard from her, and she hadn't heard from me during the war, but at the end of the war, only about 8 weeks after the surrender of the Japanese, I got a letter from her. But what was so extraordinary was that in the letter she just said, "Oh dear Mary, how nice to be able to write to you again. I must tell you what I've been doing." And she told me all sorts of things about herself and her family and what she was hoping to do and what she'd done, but she didn't mention the war, not once. She didn't say how sad it was that our two countries had been at war. She didn't say how upset she was to think of what had happened. She didn't refer to the war at all. And so far as I was concerned, an English young woman living in England with all the feelings that we had against Japan, I found this quite extraordinary. I think perhaps looking back, it was the Oriental attitude, the Japanese attitude perhaps to fighting, which perhaps she found it difficult to refer to something that had been so terrible. It was very odd.
Did you find Japanese conditions very alien to you?
Well, when we were out there before the war, Oh, quite different, yes. Everything was different. Not disagreeably so. You must remember we had tended to travel a lot because my father was in the Navy. So we were well used to other people's religions, customs, and accepted it as something interesting and always acceptable. We were never... I think this went for most naval families. Because you travelled a lot, you saw the world and you accepted other people as they were. And you didn't feel that just because they were different, that you were in any way... that your way of life was better than theirs or anything like that.
Was there any sign of disorder that you witnessed?
I don't think so. Not when we were there. There was certainly the incident, as they called it, going on in Manchuria in those days. And there used to be big processions of people clothed in wearing white clothes, because that was the colour of mourning. And I imagine that they were linked to the deaths of their soldiers in the Manchuria fighting that was going on. I know my father was very concerned about what was going on. But we were young in those days, and it really, we didn't have very much effect on us.
Did your period in Japan make you pro-Japanese?
While we were there, I don't think it made us either pro or anti, because they were just people that we lived with and people that we liked and people that we conversed with and, as a child, played with. But I certainly never felt any anti-feeling, not when I was there. It wasn't until the war that one got out of one's depths, really, when one heard what was going on.
Did you or your family have any inkling at that time that Britain and Japan might soon be at war?
As a child, I don't think I ever did. I suspect my father was very worried at the build-up of the Japanese Navy and the aggressive behaviour that Japan had shown towards China, I think, and Manchuria. So I'm sure he was worried. But we didn't realise that as children.
What rank did your father eventually rise to?
Oh, he retired as a full admiral, and he was a vice admiral when he was in the Pacific. Because he at the end of the war, he was appointed as vice admiral in command of the seagoing forces, the British Navy, out in the Pacific. Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser was the flag officer commanding the British fleet, but he remained in Sydney, and when the fleet went to sea, then my father was in command of the fleet, and he had a very active role with his relatively speaking small force, linking up with the Americans and the American fleet and trying to keep up with them with their huge resources and huge amount of money which could back the American Pacific fleet and ours, which was so far from home. And at the end of the war, I think this country was pretty exhausted and the resources to keep it going fell far short of those that the Americans had. And things like oiling and supplying the ships, so far as the British went, were very, very difficult to do.
What were your father's initials?
HB, Henry Bernard. He was Henry Bernard Hughes Rawlings.
Hughes hyphen Rawlings?
No hyphen. The Hughes was his mother's maiden name. That was a Welsh connection.
Hughes with an E.
H-U-G-A-G-S, yes, that's right.
Now, where did you go to school yourself?
I went to a school called Downhouse, which was a wonderful school outside Newbury. After we'd been in Japan for 2 years with the little school and the governess, my parents, I think quite rightly, thought that we ought to go back to school in England, particularly for my brother who was 9. And so we were sent home in the care of this very, very sweet governess. We were sent back across the Pacific, across Canada, and back to England. And because my parents were still in Japan for another year, So we were both packed off to boarding school. And I went to Downhouse, which was a very remarkable school, very advanced for its years. We didn't have to walk in crocodiles and things like that. And I was extremely happy there. Lovely place it was. And my brother went to another, to a prep school quite nearby, so that if anybody came to visit us, we were both close together and we could sort of keep in touch with each other.
How old were you when you were at Downhouse?
I think I was about 12 and a half, just under 13. I went there in 1938, I think. I think it was 1938, yes, summer 38, I think. Yes, and then my parents came back the following year, in about the January of 39, I suppose. And then the war broke out later on that year. But I was at school in Berkshire until I finished my education, when I was just before I was 18, 17 plus.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I remember it extraordinarily clearly. We went into the rectory, the vicarage as it was called in those days, and heard the broadcast. It's such a long time ago, and yet I remember it quite clearly. I suppose it must have made an enormous impression. I don't think very much happened afterwards, because we were down in Cornwall then, very country district. But the first thing that happened was that some cousins sort of more or less turned up on the doorstep, because my uncle was very worried that the Germans would instantly bomb or instantly invade, and he packed them off down to us because we were living right out in the country. And that was the first time, I think, that one realised that, as a family, that things were going to change in an extraordinary way.
Had you been dismayed when you heard the news of the war declaration?
I was only 12, so I don't think, or just 13. I don't think that I really fully understood. But yes, I was deeply shocked, because my parents were shocked and because everybody was aware that something terrible had happened. We also had at the school where I was some Jewish girls who had been sent over from Germany, presumably, for safe refuge. And they had arrived at school, and that was another sign to children of my age that there was something very frightening going on the continent, because these girls arrived as refugees, and they were absorbed into the school. But one was well aware that they were frightened individuals and were thankful to have got to England.
Did you make friends with any of them?
Well, not particular friends, but we all looked after them. I think that's what it was. I think there were about four of them, I think, or five of them. They weren't actually my age, so they weren't in the same form or class, but nevertheless we were all well aware what had happened to them and how they had been rescued from the fears of Germany.
What happened to you in the early stage of the war?
Well, we just lived in the country and slowly adapted ourselves to a new type of life, really. My father was away. He was in the Atlantic to start off with and caught up in the Norway fighting. My mother took on any wartime job that she could. She looked after the Lang girls in our area and was very busy with that. During the holidays, we were much encouraged to do all the things that English families did then. We helped to grow our own vegetables, keep the chickens and the ducks and the pigs, and help provide food for the family. Because rationing, I don't know when rationing came in, but it came in fairly early on, I think. And certainly we used to, as a family, we worked hard to grow things. And other cousins, the first lot of cousins moved away. But another lot of cousins were evacuated onto us, I should think, in about 1940, 41, I suppose. They were three children, and they'd been living in Kent, and the bombing had been very bad. And so they came down and lived with us, so that our family suddenly changed from being about six of us to 13. And that was a big change. And again, one was well aware. And all sorts of people were evacuated from Kent and Sussex and London, and they turned up down in Cornwall because it was safer there.
What was your mother's address at this time?
Where did she live?
Yes.
Oh, we lived in outside Bodmin. An old house which had been a farm. And my father was a Cornishman, you see, and my mother was a foreigner from Surrey. Now, I say that because I reckon that I'm Cornish, but over the Tamar, you're a foreigner. Certainly you were in those days. And, I mean, anybody who went to Plymouth, people took note. And if anybody went to London from Cornwall, people used to talk about it for days, because London was a foreign place in Cornwall before the war. And so when people turned up in Bodmin and the neighbouring farms, and farmers had evacuees from London, everybody knew about it, because these were foreigners. These were visitors from far, far away places. And so the local people were well aware of the change in life. And, of course, one heard about the terrible bombing in London.
How did the local people treat the incomers?
Oh, very kindly, I think. Very kindly. I never heard of unkindness. My mother had evacuees too, but usually only for a short time, because during the holidays there were so many of us around. I think she must have been a staging house for evacuees. She used to have little boys and little girls from London or from the other big cities, and then during the holidays they used to be placed with a farm or something, so that they had somewhere to live.
Were there any enemy air attacks in the Bodmin area that you knew of?
Relatively few. Certainly I was in Bodmin when we were, the place was bombed and machine gunned. They were machine gunned in the main street when I was there. We were jolly lucky that nobody was hit. But it's very frightening being machine gunned. Extraordinary. One day I was in the kitchen and in the house and heard a plane flying low, knew it was a fighter, ran out to wave, because one always waved at the RAF. And he was so low over the house that I could see his head as he turned and looked down at me, waving. And then I realised he was German. It was most extraordinary. And he zipped up the drive and up the country lane and machine-gunned a land girl who was bicycling up at the top of the lane. So, yes, it was brought home to us, that sort of thing. And then when they bombed Plymouth, we saw Plymouth burning. We went up to the moor and saw the flames, great glow in the sky. And then the next day we all went into Plymouth, all the local people, to help in the canteens and to help the wretched people who were bombed. Because it wasn't just the docks that were bombed, the whole city was bombed, and there were so many people who were killed. And it was a terrible time. So yes, one did know what was going on all right.
Was that land girl killed?
No, she wasn't. She fell off her bike into the ditch and he missed her. But it was, he was so low, it was quite extraordinary how I could see his face turn and look down at me.
What about this attack on the high street of Bodmin?
The two planes came up and machine gunned us. We were in the car, we got out of the car jolly quickly. And nobody was hit, there were bullet holes all over the place. But nobody was hit in the town. But then they turned round when they got to the town and came back and they dropped their bombs on the gasworks and one of the railway stations. There was a terrific bangs. And several people were killed in. I think a little family of about five or six people were all killed. So, you know, the war came home. And, of course, when I was at school in Berkshire, during the Battle of Britain, one saw One saw the fighters fighting high up in the sky. So one knew what was going on. My father went through those early years quite safely. It wasn't until he was during the Battle of Crete that he was wounded. He was wounded then.
What did the Battle of Britain fighting look like from the ground at Esher?
From Newbury.
From Newbury, yeah. Rather.
Oh, tiny little toy planes.
Could you distinguish
catching,
them?
Catching the sunlight. No, not when they were so high. But of course one got to know the sound of the engines. You could tell a Spitfire or a Hurricane, as opposed to the Germans. I mean, even to this day, if a Hurricane or a Spitfire flies over, I'll know it and go out. You never forget the sound, I suppose. It's the the Rolls-Royce engine, I suppose. But you can hear it. But they were so high, mostly, with these fighting that was going on, and all you could see was the sun glinting on the wings as they turned, and the vapour trails. They were like little toys high in the sky.
How did you think the battle was going at the time?
Well, one heard, I suppose, when I was at home, of course, one had the newspaper. I don't think we read the newspapers at school, but one knew what was going on. People had wirelesses, as they were called then, and you knew what was happening. One knew they were terribly dangerous days.
What did public morale seem to be like at this stage of the war, with the setbacks that were occurring?
Jolly aggressive, really. I don't think there was ever a feeling that this country was going to give in. I think there was a determination to protect this country and to prevent this country being overrun, as so much of Europe had been, that ran right through men, women and children. It was really quite extraordinary. I don't think it ever crossed anybody's mind that the country was going to give way and to allow itself to be overrun. Because you never saw a man who was out of uniform hardly ever in those days. All men were in uniform, and lots of women too. And the only men that you saw in ordinary clothes were the farming community where we lived amongst them. But all the young farmers had gone off to fight. So all the men who were working on the farms, they were all elderly. And they were all helped by the girls and the women. We all went out and helped the farmers in the harvesting, because there was a determination to carry on and do what one could. Extraordinary, really, looking back.
Did your mother seem to be much affected by the fact that her husband was in the front line, as it were?
She was a very matter-of-fact woman, with a very strong religious belief. We all went to church as a family. And I think she had immense faith in what my father was doing. And yes, she must have been very frightened an awful lot of the time. But she had a great belief that the British Navy was the best in the world and the strongest in the world, and that they would somehow...